Hi, this is Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. As we mentioned at the beginning of Monday's podcast, we have paused our coverage of the trial of Alex Murdaugh for the next 7 weeks. This week, in recognition of the death of O.J. Simpson last Wednesday, April 10th, we are reaching into the archives of Crime Story Media to present a series of special interviews related to the way that the historical narrative of Simpson's trial for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman has been preserved for posterity. Yesterday, we presented part two of Carrie Antholis' two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe-winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Today, we present part one of Carrie's two-part conversation with Ezra Edelman, producer and director of the Oscar and Emmy-winning 10-hour documentary, O.J. Made in America. During the conversation, they discuss Ezra's path into storytelling, the development of his craft as a cinematic storyteller, the evolution of his interest in sports and African American history, how he was convinced to make the film, and the process of conceptualizing and producing the documentary. One further programming reminder, in parallel with the premiere of The Jinx 2 on the Max streaming service, we are scheduling a special event for Season 10 of the Jury Duty podcast. For each of the 6 weeks of The Jinx 2 series, we will re-release four of our favorite episodes about the Durst trial from the Jury Duty feed, for a total of 24 episodes. The first episode of Jury Duty, The Durst Trial's Greatest Hits, will drop on April 22nd. Now, on to part one of Carrie Antholis' two-part conversation with Ezra Edelman, which was conducted in the spring of 2019 at USC's School of Cinematic Arts in Los Angeles.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's podcast is part one of a two-part conversation with Ezra Edelman,
producer and director of the Oscar and Emmy-winning 10-hour documentary, O.J. Made in America. During our conversation, we discussed Ezra's path into storytelling, the development of his craft, the evolution of his interest in sports and African-American history, how he was convinced to make the film, and the process of conceptualizing and producing the documentary. And so, without further ado, here is my conversation with Ezra Edelman. Where I'd like to start is by asking you to tell us a bit about your path into being a filmmaker and along the way, key incidents, influences, especially influences, and people that helped guide you and helped you shape your aesthetic and the things that matter to you.
So, you guys might be a little disappointed because my path is, I guess, a little non-traditional. I'm sort of envious of what you guys are doing, sitting in the class with Carrie right now. This is something I never got to do. My path was really learning on the job through a variety of professional opportunities. I mean, very quickly, I sort of got a job right out of college. And I worked as a researcher on the Olympics for CBS, the last time CBS had the Olympics. And so I had a job for a couple of years where I got to travel around the world and interview athletes and was responsible with a couple other people for all the background material for the Olympics. And that was basically being a reporter, journalist, writer. And off of that, and, you know, there was a big TV production, obviously, but I had never been on a shoot. And then literally after that job, which is a lot of responsibility and very well thought of, someone gave me a job as a producer making feature stories for on Olympic athletes, 4 or 5 minutes long. And I remember the first time I got an assignment to go out there to do a story. Like, I'd never been on a shoot. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where the camera was supposed to go. I didn't know where I was supposed to stand. And it was this really incredible on-the-job training. And I did this for a year working at a smaller production company. And even I remember the first story I had to do, this was dating myself a little bit, this was probably 20 years ago now, but the first story I did, we were still cutting on a linear editing system. That's the equivalent, I guess, of working with a typewriter. You had to be completely set with what you were doing from beginning to end, and if you decided halfway through that you wanted to like make a change, you'd have to go back to the beginning. And that was a lesson very quickly of let's just say I wasn't prepared. I got a chance to make some mistakes in a place that was fine to make a mistake, and I did that, learned how to interview people and whether this is something I wanted to do. It was a one-man band. I sort of go out and shoot and, you know, transcribe all my stuff and write my stories. And then soon after that, I got a job working at HBO on a show called Real Sports. And I spent, you know, 6-7 years as a producer producing magazine pieces. And I didn't have any experience doing that. I had no experience with long form. I had no experience working with a correspondent. And again, I was very fortunate that someone gave me an opportunity before I actually had experience. And that gave me sort of, again, it was another on-the-job training. And I happened to be at a company that did documentaries. And I sort of asked, I raised my hand and said, do you guys do these long-form documentaries? I worked in the sports department. And I said, I would love to do one if you guys would let me. And it was sort of begging after for a couple of years. And they finally let me make a film, and it was about the Brooklyn Dodgers, and it was primarily centered around them leaving Brooklyn to come to LA, and it was a lot about city politics and a lot about race and sports. And as soon as I got an opportunity to work on a documentary, it felt like I'd found my thing. That was what I realized, that that's what I wanted to do. I loved interviewing people versus working with talent. I really loved this longer period of really sinking into a story. I got 9-10 months to work on the film, and everything about it and what it was about was right up my alley. And so from that point on, I realized that what I wanted to do was make documentaries. I mean, the point is that I sort of have in my professional life moved forward with opportunity that I've had and been allowed to grow in terms of the medium and style as far as what I would be able to do. And I did a few films for HBO, and then I left, and then I sort of started doing things independently. I mean, to answer your question, Carrie, as far as influence and style, I mean, I would sort of say I probably suffer from having fewer influences than most. It's just sort of feeling my way through what I've done. You know, I remember watching One Day in September when it came out in 2000, and that was before I'd done a documentary. And that was really the first long-form thing I watched that I thought, like, that's something I didn't know how to do it at the time, but I thought that's something I really aspired to be able to do, which I've since been able, you know, fortunate enough to tell Kevin McDonald that when I've met him. But it felt like, oh, this is long form, mixing sports and history and journalism. I was really amazed that they could find one of the terrorists in the film that the Mossad couldn't find, and I didn't have any idea how that could be done. But that was definitely at that point, that was 25 years old when that came out, and I thought if I could ever do something like that, I'd be very happy. And then, you know, through the course of working on documentaries, I just arrived at my own style as far as interviewing style, as far as aesthetic. I mean, I probably borrowed a little bit of the aesthetic from news magazine days as far as how I like subjects to look and how tight I like to shoot things in the intimacy of a dynamic between a subject and an interviewer. So I don't know how much I answered your question, but that's a quick.
That was great. That was fantastic.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And now, back to Carrie Antholis' interview with Ezra Edelman.
Going back to your university days, you studied history at Yale. Was there a particular area of history, and were there particular thinkers, writers, journalists, historians that influenced your worldview?
Simply put, history is where I went to school. It's a popular major. It's a very sort of, it's very all-encompassing in terms of you're made sure you have to take stuff all over the place from American, internationally, all different historical periods. But I really focused on African-American history, primarily 20th century African-American history would have been what I really focused on. And I always, as much as I was a history major, I probably, if I'd gone back, I would have been an American studies major, if not an English major, because, I mean, still my focus was on, again, a certain contemporary bent. As far as people that influenced me, I don't know that there were historians that influenced me. I mean, there's certainly people that, you know, write history in nonfiction that I always love. I mean, I love the Halberstams and Remnicks and people like that. But, you know, it's like growing up and reading all the black writers from, you know, 20th century America, the Richard Wrights and the Baldwins. And then I was just always a sports nerd. And so, like, any sort of text that had to do with nonfiction and sports from the 20th century, I read. That's just what I'm, you know, schooled in. And so as much as I was a history major, you know, I wrote for the paper. That was always my beat. I've weirdly always been a sports savant. And sports and race have been my, you know, the concurrent areas of expertise that I've been focused on, and I've just absorbed everything in front of me without, so there's no seminal people or texts I really point to. I inhaled it all. I don't know.
So what was the film you worked on immediately preceding O.J. Made in America? And then what were the circumstances that, as I understand it, you were enticed to make the O.J. film?
I mean, by the way, it's an interesting thing because, again, I didn't have the wherewithal. I don't think I had the sort of direction to have made a choice to go to film school, for instance, to go, like, I want to make films. I want to make feature films or documentaries. I've just been someone that's always been slightly more reactive, even though I've had areas that I was interested in. And so, frankly, when I left HBO, it's like I'd also been very protected in the world. I'd always sort of worked in institutions. And so in terms of what was going to happen, it was very scary. And I had been very frustrated, frankly, by being in this institution and feeling like I had something as an artist, but I would have never, ever considered myself an artist, but something more to, it's like you're a worker. You're a worker in a place, and I think you know this, where it's like other people might take credit for your work, and it's the institution that's doing it. And I kind of was always like, but I'm really doing this. I'm really working my ass off to, like, make these films. And then you see outside of, you know, people who make documentaries independently, and it's all about them. And you're like, but why don't I get the same, I don't know. And so there's a little bit of a weird ego thing, but then you leave and I go, oh, this is really hard to generate stuff. And how do you actually do this? And what I was fortunate was that I had sort of worked in a genre that in some ways had been HBO for all the sports documentaries they had done. You know, by the time I left, ESPN had sort of taken over the mantle as far as just even the glut of doing them with the 30 for 30 series. And I knew the people who made the films. And when I left, they said, anytime you want to do something. And they approached me about doing a film about the Big East Conference. I don't know. This was probably 2013. And, like, again, not like something I was dying to do in my life, but it was also something that was a story that meant something to me, having grown up in Washington, was a huge Georgetown fan, and actually about 6 months before that, I really wanted to make a film about John Thompson, who was the coach at Georgetown for all these years. And I was doing it. I spent some time with it. And he initially didn't take to me after, like, agreeing to do it. And so then I thought that was, like, that was, again, a very jarring thing for me emotionally. And all of a sudden, he sort of kicked me to the curb. And then ESPN came and asked me to do this thing. And it was, the subject matter was similar, but it was also my way of telling a story about him and the school within the bounds of this film, and it was nostalgic and historical, and I said, sure, so I did that. It was a film called Requiem for the Big East, and I also did a short film for them about the Chilean national soccer team in 1973 called The Opposition, and it was about the team trying to qualify for the World Cup, and they had one last game to qualify when they were supposed to play the Soviet Union when the coup happened. And Pinochet turned the national stadium into a detention / torture center. And so the film was about how the teams qualified in, you know, in the midst of a country that was in upheaval. And long story short, because of politics, strangely, the Soviet Union of all places ended up boycotting playing there because they thought the conditions were so terrible. and Chile qualified for the World Cup because they didn't show up and they went on the field 11-0 and they went down and they scored a goal against nobody. That to me was right up my alley of what my interests were. I did that film at the Big East and then they approached me and they came to me and said, would you be interested in making a 5-hour film? And my first response was, yes, I'm interested in making a 5-hour film. And then they told me what it was about and I said, I don't want to make a film about OJ. You know, I sort of went away for a minute and thought, yeah, I don't want to make a film about OJ because everyone who wants to make a film about OJ wants to make a film about the trial and wants to make a film that is a referendum on his guilt or innocence. And I'm not interested in that. I lived through it. And then I thought, well, you're giving me all this time. What I am interested in is the guy who played football at USC. The guy who played football at USC, you know, and arrived there 2 years after the Watts riots. The guy who became famous running a football almost concurrent to the Watts riots in San Francisco in the fall of 65. And I already understood that there was a story about him in terms of him as an athlete and as a black athlete in the late 60s and the choices that he made that really had bearing on what happened in the trial and how he was defended and how he represented himself then versus how the people supported him. And I thought, like, if I could tell a story that drew a line directly from a guy who essentially said no to the Olympic Project for Human Rights and Dr. Harry Edwards, who wanted him to be a part of the politicization of black athletes at the time, that culminated in many ways with Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising a fist on the medal stand. And then here's a guy who really deracialized himself publicly and became this very obviously famous, successful football player, pitchman, movie star, and all that. And then you get to a trial and someone who had sort of in some ways gone out of his way to erase race from his public persona, you know, as we know the story, falls back on using race as a theme to get acquitted to the point where a guy walks out on, you know, when he leaves the jury box and he raises a fist. And so for me, it was like, wait, how did the guy who like walked out of a movement that culminated in that ends up being acquitted of murder, you know, 27 years later with a guy walking out and I'm like, that's the story. If I can connect those two dots, that's a good film.
So you agreed to make the film. And what was your first step in assembling a team on the one hand and then in planning your course?
Well, I think the first thing, I just started reading. I mean, I read for months. Yeah, I like assembled one person. There's one person I went to and said, I need you to produce this. But again, I even had to pitch her. I'd just say, like, it's about everything and it's about this big thing. And but for me, it was knowing sort of instinctively how many things had been done and how and like what the media sort of saturation was around this. I thought the only way that I could succeed in doing this, if I was so steeped in all of it. And really came to it with an historical perspective. So every person I talked to, I could really say, I'm not doing the thing that you're used to everyone doing. I'm really trying to, you know, take this huge long view. And I'm really trying to tell this comprehensive historical piece that is not at all salacious. And I've done my homework. And that to me was the most important thing. And just to get my ducks in a row as far as like I had thoughts, I had ideas. I had a basic architecture I thought I wanted to try to, you know, follow. But I really needed to read as much about OJ, certainly, but also about the LAPD and also about the city of Los Angeles and, you know, about the trial itself and all these different things that went into telling this. I mean, it really is the story. When I said I would have preferred majoring in American studies, this was the ultimate American studies paper. And so for me, it's like, that's great. You give me an assignment that I get to spend 3-4 months just reading books. Pretty happy. But that was the first thing I did. And it was that until I probably started hiring people 4 months after.
And then did you identify interview subjects? How many of the interviews did you bank before you started editing and collecting footage?
Well, it was really like so gigantic of an undertaking that I had to do enough interviews to have material to start editing. But there's no way the whole thing was going to be completed and it's going to be a work in progress. So if I started myself reading in May, we started shooting in October, we started editing in February.
And what percentage of the interviews had you completed by the time you started editing?
Completed half to 60%. And because of the way that the film is done, they were, in terms of then how we would edit, it was all about what we had the material to actually work on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sort of cognizant about certain things I would try to have completed, but there are certain things I just couldn't have done. And so we started working on sections where we had enough material to start. And so, no, I probably had 60% of the stuff done, probably my guess, 50 to 60. And then my last interview I did was probably in July. We were done editing in November, December.
So about 13, 14 months after you started shooting.
Yes.
And going into the filming, how are you thinking about the movements of the film? Because I've read and heard you say that you think of the entire piece as one film, but I would imagine you thought of it as movements or sections as you describe them. What were the major sections in your mind that you wanted to make sure that you covered?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think I would consider that movements, or that'd be a correct terminology. Well, for instance, I knew that it was easy for me in my brain to know that everything after the trial was after the trial. And so that was not something I was focused on at the beginning. That being said, you know, this is where you have to improvise when you have to improvise. That, you know, we ended up doing a shoot in Las Vegas based on just sort of where we're at and how certain things came before I was even prepared or I had thought about it. And so I shot interviews in Las Vegas and shot in the hotel room before I had actually conceived of, like, really what I was doing. And that was premature, and that sometimes you just can't map it out. But I really started with the historical stuff. I tried to start with the beginning. And so, I mean, like, literally the first shoot we did was in San Francisco, where OJ was from. And so, like, the first day we did three interviews, and it was with one of his childhood friends, a coach of his at junior college who also taught him, and an author. And it was like, that was like the first day, and it's always hard to just, like, pull the ripcord and start going. And, you know, we did 72 interviews. 66 of them are in the film, but two of them that were in the film were in that first day. And you're just getting your feet wet, and then you're going like, oh no, you're like, this guy was terrible. He says, and then, you know, at the same time, one of his friends who he interviewed tells this perfect story, and I'm curious about, you know, the fact that, for instance, OJ's dad is gay is something that, frankly, no one knew. It was one line in a book. I didn't know that. I read it and was like, okay, so I don't know how his friends or anyone around him, I don't know if this is something that people know, if they would volunteer, if this is like, how am I, because I'm not in the film, there's not a narrator, how am I going to be able to, like, really get someone to talk about this? You're fueled by these things that happen in these unpredictable settings. And I remember interviewing this guy, Cal Tennyson, in the first day, and, like, he brought up his mom, and he was talking about his mom and how he'd go over to OJ's house, and there's nothing in the refrigerator, and how his mom worked at the hospital. And then I sort of said, well, what about his dad? Did you ever meet his dad? And then the guy just told me the most perfect story, which is in the film, about, like, having never met his dad. And he went over one day with OJ to, like, pick up the check from his dad. And he walked in, and OJ's dad was in a bathrobe. And there's another. And he's like, it turned out, and it's obvious his dad was gay. And, you know, and I'm going like, oh, that's pretty good. I couldn't have possibly, like, gamed that. And then, like, one little thing like that sort of gets you going. It happened at the next shoot, 2 days later, was with his other friend, Joe Bell, who's my favorite character in the film, and with Dr. Harry Edwards, who it was like I could just talk, say anything, and he's going to give me. And I'm like, all right, now I feel good. But I really wanted to start in sort of the origin a little bit and grounded in the material and the history in a way that was, I knew, not salacious, in a way that once you get into the stuff later, it would be challenging and difficult, and people who knew him when he was in LA. And so that's where I started. And then after that, it's a little bit of a free for all because you're organizing shoots based on what you can do. So I worked in New York. We would plan a trip to LA. It was kind of like a once every month thing. And then you're going like, who can we get to talk to us? And we might get one person or two people, but then you're trying to justify a trip to go and do more stuff. And then you end up having to, like, go forward. So then you just start to improvise. And so there are days where, you know, there's one day I interviewed Tom Riccio, who's the guy who was in the robbery in the hotel. It was the same day I interviewed Nicole Brown's sister. And there's another day you interview Carl Douglas. then I went and interviewed a guy at USC, a professor there. And so that's another reason why you have to be so grounded with all the research at the beginning. And you have to have a sense of what you're doing, because you can't control how you're doing it. And you can't be doing your research incrementally and going like, oh, so now I'm going to do this. It's all a blueprint somewhere in there that you fluidly can go from person to person. And then within an interview, you're going from subject to subject based on that's how I do interviews. I'm not sitting with a piece of paper in front of me. I sort of prepare for an interview like I'm preparing for a test. And so then you don't know what question you're going to get, because you don't know what's going to come out of someone's mouth. You don't know where your head's going to go. You veer in a different direction because you want to have a conversation, and that's the best interview. And so that's just sort of...
Did you do all 72 interviews yourself? And who was your chief sounding board during this process?
Me.
Really? So there's not a creative producer that you have, or the ESPN executive? Is there anybody?
I had three producers in the film. One main producer, Caroline Waterlow, and then we hired two really talented women, Tamara Rosenberg and Nina Kristic. And Nina's an archival producer. She's incredible. Tamara was the one who was, so it would be Tamara in terms of, she was the one that was responsible for outreach and talked to a lot of people and called a lot of people, which is my least favorite thing. I don't like cold calling people. I don't always love doing pre-interviews with people. And so I guess with her, but you know, I do all this work and I write out like a 65-page document that's like me writing the story.
Got it.
And so like, everyone's already catching up. I mean, I don't mean this in a weird way. I just am sort of have obsessively thought about this. And so I do talk to people, and I do talk to Tamara. But in some ways, I just take the onus on myself. With this, because of the time and because of the scope of it, I gave my editors, there's a lot more freedom to create the scene. So even with that, I would still want to put the architecture of a scene together with the sound, and then they could just go. But like, I had never done a film where I hadn't seen every piece of footage. And with this, it was impossible. So I would be watching scenes after putting together a paper cut with just sound that, like, I'd go, oh, I didn't know that any of this stuff. And I'd be asking questions. So it works both ways. There are certain things you do make sure you watch beforehand. If you're going to watch someone who's on the stand during the trial, I'm going to watch their testimony and stuff like that.
That concludes part one of my conversation with Ezra Edelman.
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, The Legacy of the OJ Trial. Please join us on our next installment as we present part two of Carrie's interview with Ezra Edelman, producer and director of the Oscar and Emmy-winning 10-hour documentary, OJ Made in America. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page. You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie and Tholis. It was co-produced by yours truly, Chris Terracone, and edited by Tristan Friedberg Rodman. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.